Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the club representing the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. I will be your chair for this evening's program, Environmental Success Stories, with three distinguished environmentalists who have fought long and hard for your and my and everyone's health and welfare. Tonight they're sharing good news, the environmental success stories that we can share with you about Monterey Bay and Laguna San Ignacio. I think we fight so hard on the victory, on the battles that we have, that sometimes we don't talk a lot about our environmental successes. And to me, it's really important that we share when we have those successes. Stephen Palumbi, right with us, is the director of the Hopkins Marine Station in Monterey. And Stephen is the author of The Death and Life of Monterey Bay, which was just out this week. It's just out this week. Joel Reynolds is the director of legal affairs, and Jacob Scheer is the director of global strategy and advocacy for the Natural Resources Defense Council. The Natural Resources Defense Council, as we know, NRDC, is now in its 40th year of advocacy and fighting to protect our planet. Jacob and Joel are contributors to the effort that was made to save San Ignacio, Laguna San Ignacio, and it's written about in the Conservation in the Internet Age, a pioneer publication recognizing the power, early recognizing the power of the Internet and electronic media in our environmental protection. So tonight we'll start with Stephen and then move to Jacob and Joel. Stephen?
Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you all for coming this evening. As Anne said, some of us are got to get rid of the little step here. So, as Anne said, what we're going to try to concentrate on tonight are our success stories, and I'm going to tell you one from somewhere close to here, Monterey Bay, and it's a story that not only tells us that things can get better, though we don't usually hear that, but also tells us that it's people that make them get better, and that those people needed certain traits: persistence, passion, patience, and it worked. And it can work in other places as well. And the reason why this is a really important story to tell, not only mine but everyone's, is that if you think about what you've heard from the ocean lately, it's mostly bad news. The oceans are in trouble, and that's why there's so much bad news. I've contributed to some of the stories that have come out over the last couple of years about the ocean being in trouble. The science we do helps us understand that. But as I'm flying around the world telling people about how the oceans are in trouble and how we really need to care about that and we need to do something about that, I live in one of the most amazingly beautiful places in the entire country, on Monterey Bay. And as I go to work every day, there's a conflict between feeling a little guilty about living in such a gorgeously beautiful place, but also trying to understand why Monterey Bay is so beautiful. Was it always this amazingly beautiful? It turns out the answer is no. It was not always beautiful. 80 years ago, it was pretty much an industrial hellhole. Industrial canning, the sardine industry, pollution of the air and water wrecked the ability of people in Monterey and Pacific Grove to live the lives that they had gotten used to. So we began to explore this particular story about how Monterey Bay, how it got ruined, and more importantly, how it recovered, and the people who brought it back. Now, this is the subject of our new book, The Death and Life of Monterey Bay, and I'm proud to say that the co-author is Carolyn Sotka, who can't be here this evening. Carolyn lives now in South Carolina, where she helps run the Center for Ocean Health there. She happens to be, unfortunately, on an island on the Great Barrier Reef this very minute, and sends her regrets. She can't be here. The the story of any place that is in North America, the West Coast, almost any place in the world, starts out with Western explorers writing about the incredible wildlife diversity that they found when they got here. And then what happens is, serially, one by one, species that are important, especially in the marine environment, are found to be commercially valuable, and they're taken one by one. And the basic pattern is this: find out that something is important, figure out a market, take it till it's gone, then move on to the next thing. And that's the story that's played out in Monterey Bay as well. Otters are the first example. Otters were sold to the Canton market, Guangdong in China. Their sale price was between $30 and $50 in the late 1700s, to give you an idea of what that kind of money that was worth. You could buy a house in San Diego for $90. In the late 1700s. So these were very valuable things. And as a consequence, we have records of almost 40,000 otter pelts being taken from Central and Southern California just over about a 20-year period. Those are the established records. Who knows how many more? People estimate about 100,000 otters were taken from our coastline just in that quick period of time. Well, that has an ecological impact as well, because otters, as you might know, are small little marine mammals, are one of the only marine mammals without blubber. The reason why they don't have blubber is because they have the most amazing fur in the world that catches air and insulates them, hence the value. But it also means they eat all the time. A 60-pound otter needs to eat about 20 pounds of fresh seafood a day, or it loses weight. 3 days without eating, it's dead. So otters eat a lot, and what they like to eat are abalone and sea urchins, their favorite foods. And by being in a normal density, they keep the abalone and the sea urchins in check. Those, if they aren't in check, would eat the kelp forest. So when you take the otters away, what happens is the ecosystem goes way out of balance. The herbivores, the urchins and the abalone, become much, much more abundant, and then the kelp forest begins to decline. So even a long time ago, by our standards, in the early 1800s, when the otters were taken away, the whole West Coast ecosystem was fundamentally changed. Kelp forests were thin and spindly. The species that lived in them were no longer as abundant as they used to be. The next 100 years or so saw the same sort of thing play out. I won't go into it. It's in the book. The first third of the book is about these serial changes in wildlife: whales, seals, seabirds, abalone were all taken bit by bit, and the ecosystem was pushed further and further and further away from what it used to be. I should also say that another collaborator we had on the book was the person who did these line drawings you see there. They'll be scattered through the work. It's Lauren Palumbi. She's got red hair, in case anybody notices her. the fishery that Monterey is really known for is its sardines, the silvery sheen that made Monterey a huge amount of money. In the heyday of sardine canning, Monterey was the biggest canning operation on the west coast of the United States. 1 million pounds of fish a day were processed by those canneries. And that created a huge problem. This is a picture of 1932 above the canneries, showing some of the sludge that was coming out of the canneries at the time. You can also maybe see some big white dots. Those are part of the sardine fleet, and little tiny white dots there. Anybody have an idea what those little tiny white dots are? Think of the worst bird in the world. Seagulls, exactly. So thousands, hundreds of thousands of seagulls were waiting near the canneries. What were they waiting for? They were waiting for fish heads, fish guts, fish tails, the offal that rained down out of the canneries, because the floors of the canneries, which were built over the water, the floors had slats that were a half inch between them, the wooden slats. And so they would sluice all that stuff off the cannery floor into the bay. And Hopkins professor Rolf Bolin wrote in the early 40s that the fumes from the scum floating on the waters of the bay were so thick and so bad they turned lead-based paints black. It was a bad place to live. You couldn't breathe the air. You certainly didn't want to get in the water. So there's a quick... Monterey Bay was ruined. But that's only the beginning of the story, because people started fighting back around the 1930s when that ruin really first started happening. And we first turn our attention to an amazing woman named Julia Platt, who is one of the very first people to fight back and say the ocean needs protection, and she had an idea about how to do it. Now, she was an amazing person. She had a PhD in zoology. She got it in 1898. You could not get a PhD in zoology in 1898 in the United States if you were a woman, so she had to go to Germany to get it. She came back to the United States, couldn't find the job she wanted in colleges because she could only get hired in women's colleges. And she settled in Pacific Grove, where Stanford has its marine station, the Hopkins Marine Lab. She became a civic activist in town and spent the next several decades pushing for ocean access, ocean health, and general civility of Pacific Grove. One of her most famous exploits before she became mayor was this one. Pictured here, part of the shore was being blocked by a house along the beach, and as you may well know, the beach in California is open, free to the public. Julia found that to be completely unacceptable and railed about this all over town. The owner, Mrs. McDougall, refused to do anything about a gate locked and preventing people from getting to the beach. Julia broke the lock, Mrs. McDougall put it back. Julia broke the lock again, Mrs. McDougall put it back and stationed her husband near the gate. Julia took an axe and a crowbar and a ladder and a photographer to the gate and ripped it down. And she also left this placard behind. It gives you an idea of who Julia was and what the kind of thing that Julia the kind of impact that she liked to have. The placard says, "This entrance to the beach must be left open at all hours when the public might reasonably wish to pass through. I act in the matter because the Council and Police Department of Pacific Grove are men and possibly somewhat timid." So, Julia was somebody not to be trifled with. She hatched a plan for saving part of the shoreline, even though she couldn't stop the canneries. First part of the plan was to announce in a newspaper ad that she was not an atheist. Then she ran for mayor of Pacific Grove. She won. Her only campaign slogan was, "It will take a good man to beat me." None did, and she was elected 2-1 in 1931. She immediately started working on the pollution from the canneries. No, that was not a winnable fight. Instead, what she did was she put together the very first citizen-led marine protected area in California, and I think in the entire United States. She established the Hopkins Marine Life Refuge, and she established the Pacific Grove Marine Life Gardens, and she wrote into the minutes of the city council meeting in Pacific Grove this quote, "From where the tiny larvae may swim or be carried by currents to all points on the shore and be attached, grow up, and replace those taken for food or curio." Now, those of us who have been working in marine protected area science over the last couple of years, you could just about read that in a paper that's published now. This is a woman far ahead of her time, and she knew that protecting an area of the ocean was an incredibly important legacy in allowing the ocean to come back to life. And come back to life it did, but not for many decades, and this is where patience comes in. Julia died a few years after 1931, and about a couple decades later, the sardine industry died as well. We cover that in the book. I encourage you to read it 2 or 3 times, allow your friends to read it, and have conversations about why the sardines collapsed, a combination of overfishing and climate change, climate shifts, that had doomed the sardine fishing. But while that's going on, another amazing and unexpected thing happened along the shores of Monterey Bay, and that's that south of Monterey, along the Big Sur coast, much to everyone's complete surprise, otters were rediscovered when they built the Bixby Bridge towards Big Sur. Now, otters have been thought to be extinct along the south coast of California. They weren't. They're protected by a set of people there, hidden from view because the rest of the country wasn't ready to have them back. But once they were discovered, they crept up the coast and began to expand their populations. They got close to Monterey in 1963, and at that point, they entered the bay again. And this is where Julia's reserve played a huge role. And, okay, it's 1963. Julia died in 1935. So many years later, the reserve played a role because That reserve was covered by abalone, their favorite food of otters. And when the otters came back into Monterey Bay, they made a beeline for their favorite food. They established a population there, and they have been there ever since. Well, by coming back to that area, they reestablished the kelp forest there. They spread out from there all along Monterey. They reestablished the kelp forest along the central coast of California. They brought back the species that were an important part of the kelp forest, seals, fish, seabirds. But they were also helped by other kinds of things going on at the same time in the early 70s. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, banning DDT, the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And so the reassembly of the ecosystem of Monterey Bay, sparked by Julia, made possible by the return of the otters, is also pushed along by these series of major national legislation that protected the ecosystem broadly. Well, usually in a story like this, when things start to get better and the fish began to return to an ecosystem, that's when people start eating it again to make money. And then you get into a cycle. It's okay. You eat it. It declines. It gets better. You eat it. It declines. And the cycle goes on and on, but the environment erodes. In this case, though, they didn't just start eating Monterey Bay again. And what was the reason for that? A different economic model for what a healthy ecosystem is good for. And that model, no pun intended, is shown here. With Julie Packard and a model of the Monterey Bay Aquarium in the late 1970s when it was first being built. And behind it, the derelict Hovden Cannery, where the Monterey Bay Aquarium is now, next to the Hopkins Marine Station, and the site of where the aquarium was being built at the time. This was a very different kind of aquarium. This was an aquarium that didn't have a big coral reef. It didn't have a big shark tank at the time. Instead, it showed the life of Monterey Bay, and it was built by four friends, or conceived by four friends. These are two of them, Steve Webster and Chuck Baxter, who was a teacher at San Jose State and a teacher at Hopkins, along with Nancy Burnett and her husband Robin Burnett, were the four people who initially thought about the aquarium, and then Nancy's sister, Julie Packard, came in. The Packard family began to build the aquarium. The idea there was that a healthy ecosystem could be used to entertain people, amaze them, educate them, that it could be used as the center for an economy that could grow and replace the economy that used to be there based upon the extraction of marine resources. That idea that a healthy marine ecosystem was more for just eating has made a huge difference to the economy of Monterey Bay. Monterey now is home to a wide variety of different kinds of enterprises. There's still fishing. There's lots of tourism. There's science, education, beauty, and a lot of permanent residents there. The balance of all these things together is something that not only is allowed by having a healthy marine ecosystem, but one that is allowed by having a diverse human economic system. So as a biologist, I talk a lot about the importance of marine biological diversity. But in writing this book, I've discovered a new kind of diversity that is also really important. I mean, I didn't discover it, but it was new to me. That is human economic diversity and the ability of different human economic interests to come to a balance and maintain an ecosystem in a better state. Along the way, to make things better has demanded a lot of human passion. It's demanded people to do things that they knew were right, even though they wouldn't work out right away. It's demanded vision. It's demanded protection of species that we couldn't necessarily put an economic value on right away, like humpback whales, but we knew it was important to do. And it depends on science and intuition about what actually is going on in the bay. The reason for writing this book about the bay was because this story has ended up being a story more about the people that have brought the bay back than the kinds of problems that the bay might have had. An environmental book typically talks about problems, shows you how awful they are, and in the last chapter, proposes some solutions to them. In fact, what we have here is that the first chapters are the problems and all the rest of it are the solutions that have come by. These are not solutions in the future. These are solutions in the past. And those solutions actually have a lot to tell us about what we might do in the future. This is a book talk, after all, and so I thought I'd read you a little bit just at the end, partly because it shows the kind of tone that we tried to reach in the book. This is not a science book. And partly because as we were searching for a way to end the book, we needed an image that was pretty strong, that stood up with Julia Platt and Ed Ricketts and Julie Packard and all of the other characters, and the otters, they're so cute, in the story. We searched for the right image of what was going on that really we could end with. And we found that image at the very top of the aquarium. The very roof of the aquarium has a machine running. It's been running since 1984, practically nonstop. It was built by David Packard. And it's the machine that moves the water in the kelp tank in the aquarium. Has anybody been to the aquarium? Ever seen the kelp tank? Notice the water moves? So here's the image that we decided we wanted to wrap this up with. Down below in the area around the kelp tank, visitors stand entranced by the tank, parents and children staring into the kelp forest, unconsciously swaying with the surging waters. And have you seen them? They do. They move like that. The kelp forest has been plucked from the bay outside, plumbed and piped, and displayed for millions to enjoy. But just beyond the walls lie mile after mile of real kelp forest, swaying to the heartbeat of nature's cycles, populated by protected otters and nurturing a recovering ecosystem. In the aquarium, Dave Packard's piston pulses the kelp back and forth. In the bay, it's the ebb and flow of human action that sets the cycle of ecological health. The cycle is positive now, and the forest has responded. It's the duty of those of us swaying to these cycles to learn the lesson of this recovery, to celebrate it here, and to create it elsewhere. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Steve. That was a lovely ending. I'm still swaying, by the way. Oops.
I'm going to give you your computer.
Okay, sorry.
For our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, Environmental Successes, about Monterey Bay and Laguna San Ignacio. We just heard from Stephen Palumbi. We will now hear from Jacob Scher and Joel Reynolds about Laguna San Ignacio. And I think it's Jacob who is behind me and who will start us off.
Okay. Good evening, and maybe I'll just say a few introductory words while we hope and pray that the PowerPoint emerges. Okay. Steve, what did you do to me?
You might.
Okay. Oh, I got you. Okay. No? Excuse me one second. Whoop. Okay. There we go. Okay. Good evening, and I first want to thank, on behalf of Joel Reynolds and myself, Ann Clark, for organizing this evening. And I want to thank all of you for coming, and it's wonderful to see so many old friends and fellow whale watchers. It's really been great to come out to San Francisco this week. I arrived yesterday, and I was able to enjoy the victory in the World Series of the San Francisco Giants. And tonight we're going to be celebrating another victory, and that's the victory that NRDC and a number of environmental groups had 10 years ago in stopping plans by Mitsubishi to build the world's largest salt works right next to a very special place called Laguna San Ignacio. So let's go to Laguna San Ignacio. If you sort of work your way down from San Francisco beyond Monterey Bay to Los Angeles, San Diego, and you keep on going down the Baja Peninsula, sort of midway, you'll find a little lagoon called Laguna San Ignacio, which is about 17 miles long and about 2 to 4 miles wide. It's a really absolutely magnificent place where the desert mountains meet the sea. It's an area of great beauty, and for those of us that spend our lives, I'm losing control of this, it's a place where people who spend their lives looking at computer screens and books can really have an opportunity to take in some extraordinary vistas. It's a place of where nature really is still dominant. There are only about 5,000 people living within 50 miles of the Laguna, and there are about 200 or 300 fishermen who live on the shores of the Laguna, but for the most part, it's an area where nature still reigns free. It's also an area of extraordinarily important biological productivity. It's the site of the northernmost expanse of mangroves. If this picture were taken in Costa Rica, these mangroves, instead of being 4 or 5 feet tall, would be 100 feet tall. And these mangroves are extraordinarily important as a nursery for marine life and also as a repository and refuge for an extraordinary range of bird life as well. The area also is home to a lot of different, about 300 different species of mammals and reptiles, including the pronghorn antelopes, which are highly endangered. But the giants of the lagoon are the California gray whales, the giants of the area are the California gray whales, which come to this area every winter at the end of a 3,000-mile migration from their summer feeding grounds off of Alaska. And they come there each year, and there'll be hundreds in the lagoon to mate. And this is actually a mating scrum of males and females. And then a year later, the pregnant females return to give birth to their babies. And at any given time, you'll find 300 or 400, as many as 300 or 400 gray whales in this little lagoon. It's one of the few places in the world that you can actually go whale watching from the shores. And in addition to the whales coming every winter to Laguna San Ignacio, you also have now about 4,000 to 5,000 people who come to the area to do whale watching. It's fairly tight. It's very tightly regulated and controlled. And for those of you, I know there are a number of you here that have been there, it's an extraordinary experience. In the background, you can see one of the whale watching camps that are set up each winter to accommodate ecotourists. And then you can get out in the boats, and here you can see in the foreground a mother whale, and in the back, one of the babies. And what we saw starting in the early 70s was the beginning of sort of friendly behavior. This had never been seen before, but these whales actually started approaching the fishermen. And today it's very close. It's very possible to get very, very up close and personal with these extraordinary mammals. Here's someone touching a whale. Here's someone touching the baby whale with its mouth open. And here's someone in serious close contact with a whale. The Mexican government understood the importance of this area. And it actually had 4 levels of protection, including being a part of a biosphere reserve and a World Heritage Site. But in 1995, I got a call from a very well-known environmentalist and author in Mexico City named Homero de Regis, and he said he wanted to know whether or not NRDC would sign on to an ad that they wanted to put into the New York Times opposing plans to build the world's largest salt works right next to a place called Laguna San Ignacio. And my initial response is, Laguna what? But Homero persisted, and I called my good friend Joel Reynolds, and we started learning about this special place and the nature of this threat, and that led to the beginning of one of the largest environmental campaigns ever, which my colleague Joel Reynolds will now describe. And I apologize for this. While Joel starts, why don't I see if I can get this PowerPoint to behave, but go ahead.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here. Actually, it's a privilege to participate in any panel that's called Environmental Success Stories. It doesn't always happen that way in our business, I have to tell you. And it's also, I just want to say, a great pleasure for me to participate in a panel with my colleague Jacob Scher, who is, in my opinion, one of the finest environmental lawyers, international environmental lawyers and strategists of our generation. So this campaign that we've been talking about, I think, is something that he and I are both quite proud of. It's an extraordinary area. You can tell already from the pictures that you have seen, even if you haven't had the pleasure of being there, but you don't have to take our word for it. This is one of these rare places on Earth that has been repeatedly recognized by governments as an extraordinary place. It's a biosphere reserve. It's a whale sanctuary. It's a migratory bird sanctuary. It's a World Heritage Site, and it's the last place on Earth where gray whales breed and calve undisturbed by human intrusion. It is absolutely the wrong place for the world's largest industrial salt works, and yet that is what, in 1995, Mitsubishi Corporation and the Mexican government had in mind. So what you see before you is a kind of a rough map of what was planned. Here it is an industrial facility of some 116 square miles with evaporation ponds on the northern end of the lagoon, concentration ponds and other industrial facilities, crystallization ponds, a pier, conveyors on the western coast of this very special lagoon. 116 square miles of industrial development, about the size of San Francisco. Here you see some of the machines involved in salt development about 100 kilometers north of this location at a place called Guerrero Negro, which is where Mitsubishi and the Mexican government have had a salt manufacturing facility since the mid-1950s. They feared that they were running out of room, and so they decided they wanted to expand, and it wouldn't be that big of a deal. They were planning to pump 6,000 gallons per second out of this lagoon 24 hours a day. They were going to create billions of gallons of toxic salt brine every year. There would be a million-ton stockpile of salt, and a two-kilometer pier built in the Bay of Whales through the migration path of gray whales. This is a picture of some of the detritus associated with industrial development at the existing saltworks factory 100 kilometers to the north. So this was a battle, actually, that when we undertook it, everybody said could not be won. Mitsubishi Corporation, of course, is one of the largest multinational operations in the world. It had never backed down in the face of environmental pressure, notwithstanding many attempts to do so in connection with many of its activities around the world. The Mexican government was a joint venture partner in this. It saw this as economic development in a region that needed roads, schools, health centers, and jobs, although how many jobs would be created by a facility of this kind, of course, is a matter of dispute. NRDC undertook opposition to this, and as so often is the case, you don't know how you're going to fare ultimately when you take on something like this. But this ultimately, over a period of 5 years, became the largest public campaign ever undertaken by NRDC. And one of the great things about winning a campaign is that when you look in the rearview mirror, every move you made looks like it was a stroke of brilliance. And I would have to say that is the case here. If you lose, on the other hand, then everybody starts pointing the finger at colleagues and saying, well, we shouldn't have done this and we shouldn't have done that, and we have been spared that. I frequently give talks about this campaign because it's a wonderful example, as Ann pointed out, of how you do a campaign, an environmental campaign in the 21st century. And that that talk can go anywhere from an hour to 2 hours. We don't have that luxury, so I'm just going to run over a few points that I think are interesting. I mean, we did all the things you do in a campaign. You know, we communicated with the opposition very, very early on to let them know who we were and what our position was. We developed a coalition, which ultimately turned out not to be just a domestic coalition, the largest environmental coalition in Mexico's history, but also a very effective international coalition. We did all the administrative and legal advocacy, which you always have to do in any environmental proceeding. We had to generate a public profile, not only for Laguna San Ignacio, but also for the threat to it, and there are a number of strategies that we undertook to accomplish that. We worked with some of the leading scientists in the world, and I've passed out a copy of one full-page ad that we put together, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute because it was a particularly effective strategy in this campaign. We engaged with international tribunals, once again, to focus pressure on the Mexican government and a profile internationally. We worked with the local communities in the region to educate them, because all they were hearing when we came in was what the Mexican government and Mitsubishi told them about all the benefits that they would receive. And because if you don't win the hearts and minds of the local population, you don't win. That's the reality of this. And so that was a very important part of our work. We spent a lot of time with Mexican politics in Mexico City, with members of the legislature and the environmental ministry. And ultimately, we even undertook an economic boycott, a Don't Buy It campaign, which I'm going to say a few things about. All right, so just moving quickly ahead, I want to talk about this element of science. Typically what happens in these campaigns is you get a dispute among scientific experts. You have a multi-million-dollar environmental assessment that is produced by the proponent, in this case Mitsubishi, and of course that's what they plan to do. They said, wait till our environmental assessment comes out before you make a judgment. We'll abide by the results. Why won't you? What you end up with is a dispute between our scientists and their scientists, and we didn't want to get in that position. So what we did in this case was to retain one of the great whale scientists in the world, Dr. Roger Payne. He was one of the co-discoverers of the fact that humpback whales sing. He became our chief scientific advisor on the campaign, and he helped us to draft a 500-word statement, which is reflected in this ad. And then instead of getting 1,000 marine biologists to sign on to it, which we could have done and is typically done in many campaigns, we decided we wanted to instead get a limited number, in this case about 35, of the biggest names in science in the world. Not limited to marine biologists, but across the spectrum of science. And the goal was not to engage in a debate about birth rates in the lagoon or the impact of salt brine on whales and all that kind of thing. What we wanted to do was to get a statement from these scientists that basically said, this is a quadruply protected area. As a matter of policy, this is an area that we've determined needs to be protected. It's not a question open for scientific dispute. It's not a matter of science. Building this facility will pose an unreasonable risk to all the resources, including the whales in this. And there's nothing that science can tell you that will eliminate that risk. And you'll see on this list, we have 9 Nobel laureates. We have a very impressive group of people, Ed Wilson, James Watson, David Baltimore, Richard Dawkins, Murray Gell-Mann, Tom Eisner. I mean, these are very big names in science. And the fact is Mitsubishi never saw it coming and never figured out how to respond to it. And ultimately, in the end, they identified this as a very effective tactic, which really surprised them because typically scientists, will not do that. But in this particular case, because of those quadruple designations of this being a uniquely special site, they were willing to put their names on the line. And we put this in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, La Reforma in Mexico City, the International Herald Tribune. We spent a lot of money getting this out there, and it was a very effective tactic throughout. All right. So if Stephen has some comments on that later, I'd love to hear him, because it is an interesting use of science. I also want to talk about international engagement. we spent a lot of time working with the World Heritage Committee of UNESCO. It's a international tribunal established to protect unique natural heritage and cultural heritage. And in this particular case, Laguna San Ignacio was designated as a World Heritage Site. But what we did was to file a petition with the World Heritage Committee asking that it be elevated to a very select list of international sites called World Heritage in Danger. Now, this was an example of a petition we didn't expect to win because Mexico, the host country for this site, was never going to agree to it. But we were able to generate an enormous amount of pressure on Mexico from other countries. We generated a profile of in the media for this. And ultimately, the World Heritage Committee actually sent a fact-finding mission to Mexico to investigate. And then they issued a report. And ultimately, when the president of Mexico canceled the project in 2000, he specifically said this has nothing to do with the environmental campaign, it has nothing to do with the whales, but we do have this report from the World Heritage Committee which says that it will hurt the landscape, and therefore we're going to cancel the project. So it was a very interesting thing, and we've got some excerpts here from Jacob Scher's diary, which is now called a blog, but in those days there was no such thing as a blog. We also spent an enormous amount of time and resources on communication, not just in the U.S., but in Mexico, in Japan, in Germany. These are full-page ads at various points. You have to decide, because they're so expensive, you have to be very careful when you use them and why. And as to each, we had very good reasons for using. This is one heritage of business or humanity. Here's another one. For salt making, there are excellent alternatives. For nature, there are not. This is one that was we published in the Los Angeles Times when we undertook an economic boycott against the project, focused in California. We did ads on the CBS Evening News. We did full-page ads. We got a list of some 40 cities and counties to pass resolutions opposing this project, and we also got the California Coastal Commission to oppose it. Now, was this a project within their jurisdiction? No, probably not. But in California, there's a sense of ownership for the California gray whale, and that was the connection. And again, Mitsubishi never saw this coming. How important was it? Well, it kept the drumbeat going. Every week there was some new story about some new county or some new city which had jumped into this battle opposing Mitsubishi. And I have to say, I think it was kind of irritating after a while to this multinational corporation and the government of Mexico. And who knows whether it was the straw that broke the camel's back. But eventually, after about 4 months of this campaign, the president of Mexico called a press conference and canceled the project. So that's the story doesn't end there, and I'm going to turn it back over to Jacob very quickly so he can tell you about the Laguna San Ignacio Conservation Initiative, which we've undertaken to preserve the area in perpetuity. Thank you very much.
I'm going to take about 5 minutes to tell you about what's happened over the last 10 years because it became quite clear to us that if we were going to be able to protect and preserve this area forever, we really had to engage with the local community and to make sure that they saw sustainable economic alternatives. Because one thing we've seen, not only at the lagoon but all over the world, is that quite often you can beat back one threat and then it's supplanted by another. And really what as Joel indicated, what was really critical and one of the other turning points in this campaign was when we were able to really start engaging with local people. And when they really started to understand that their interest as ecotourism operators, as fishermen, as inhabitants in this area would be deeply threatened by this laguna. And once we got involved, we gave them the courage to speak out. So we felt that even after March of 2000, when the threat from Mitsubishi was gone, that it was really important for us to stay engaged. Like all of us, you know, they're interested in their own well-being and the well-being of their families. And we started really working with them. Here's a picture part of the effort that we made to improve the schoolhouse. Here we're installing solar panels. We also got them connected by the Internet and set up a computer lab. And in this picture, if you look in the back, you'll see a boat which has modern four-stroke engine. When we first started going there in the mid-90s, everybody had these two-stroke engines that were extraordinarily inefficient and rather polluting. And we were able to create a loan program which enabled all the local fishermen to obtain these new, more modern outboard engines, which had the benefit not only of being less polluting, but using a lot less energy and less fuel. But about 5 years ago, we decided, you know, we had to do more than just these small loan programs and this small focus on working with the villages and communities, but to really get involved in trying to protect and preserve these areas to assure that the Mitsubishi project would never rise up again, or there would be other some other large-scale development. So working with a group, a number of other groups, we started doing land conservation, which, and I've done a lot of things in my career at NRDC, but I never thought I was going to be involved in trying to get conservation easements on property in the middle of Mexico. But that's something that we've done, and we've had a lot of success. If you look at the chart here on number five, just west of the, it'd be on the, on your, number five, it's an area on the west side of the lagoon where you have the whale watching activities, and we've been able to secure easements on 140,000 acres of land where the landowners have agreed to use that, that property in a way that maximizes the conservation values. We've also made a lot of progress on in that little triangle right in the center, item number four, where we decided that we're actually going to buy that critical piece of land outright. And then finally, we've done very well, and we've made a lot of progress in the area number two, which is on the east side of the lagoon, which actually is federal land. It's owned by the Mexican government. And we've been working for about a year now to get the Mexican authorities to transfer authority over that land to the Protected Areas Agency, and then hopefully then the next step to turn management of the property over to one of our partner groups, ProNatura. And our goal with all of this is basically to get higher levels of legal protection on all this land around the lagoon. It's also been extraordinarily valuable, particularly through the easements, in putting more money into the communities so they can start diversifying economically. And as a result of the work we've done so far, it's enabled a lot of the local residents to begin creating nurseries. One gentleman went ahead and started getting goats and actually producing cheese, and it's really helped make sure that these communities remain vibrant. This is a picture that was taken in March of a 10th anniversary celebration we had of the victory over Mitsubishi. The cake is in the form of a whale, but I can assure you that no whale parts were used in making it. And it was really an amazing celebration. And I think one of the things that we've tried to do every year since the victory, and we did it last March, is to really give the children of the lagoon an opportunity to get out in a boat and actually get to see whales. Many of these kids actually live in the area and never really get a chance to go out and see them. And it's really quite amazing to see their sorts of reactions. And I'm going to end up with this photo. This is a young guy who's named Tito. He's 24 years old. He grew up at the lagoon, and he's a good friend of my son. And Tito's a fisherman. He's married. He's got a child. He also works as a cook in the whale-watching camps. And what he, to me, the thumbs up really sort of represents the fact that there's real hope for this area, because we have now a whole new generation of people living in that area that love this place as much as we at NRDC, and those of you who have been there have loved it, and I think really give us great hope that this very, very special place will be protected and preserved forever. Thank you very much.
For our radio audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and the program is Environmental Success Stories with Stephen Palumbi, Jacob Scheer, and Joel Reynolds. And we have question time now for a few minutes, and we'll take questions from the audience. I'll walk around. Remember what I mentioned before, speak into the microphone. Thank you.
I understand you said the otters had come back. to Monterey Bay.
Yes.
And but I understand the Otter Project says otters are again in trouble. Are they also there in Monterey Bay in trouble?
Sure. The question was that otters have come back in Monterey, and they have. They've expanded along the West Coast, but that recent reports have suggested that otters are again in trouble. And I have to say, even though the theme of this is success stories, that otters are still in danger. We're not killing them for hats anymore. But they're living in a coastline that is full of people, full of cities, full of runoff, and the toxic load of otters right now is higher than it's ever been. They're exposed to diseases they've never had to deal with before, and populations are no longer increasing. Now, we don't know why they're no longer increasing. Their populations have gone up to about Año Nuevo along the central coast here. They haven't gone much further than that. They seem to have stalled in their expansion. And that's a danger sign for a biologist, because biology is about expansion and population growth. And when something stalls, that means that the normal reproductive way the population works is a little bit broken, at least. So not knowing why they've stalled is a problem. And trying to fix that problem is something that people have been really concerned about.
Yes, I was wondering what lessons from your success at San Ignacio Lagoon could be applied in working with the Japanese to protect the bluefin tuna, which I think recently didn't go as well.
I think it's a really good question. I wish I had a good answer for you. I think that's one of the great disappointments at CITES last year was how successful the Japanese were at defeating all the efforts to protect the bluefin tuna. I think we were very disappointed in the extent to which the U.S. government acted in that particular proceeding. I think that the issue of fisheries resources and the Japanese is a very complicated one, and we get asked that question a lot, particularly in the context of the International Whaling Commission. Why is it that the Japanese continue to insist on killing whales, even though there really isn't much of a market for consuming them anymore, even within Japan? And I think when you're talking about bluefin tuna, it's much worse, because there's a tremendous market for consuming bluefin tuna. I think that what we were able to do at Laguna San Ignacio probably had something to do with I think it's unique in the sense that it's tied to a particular place. It's tied to international designations, which make it clear that it's special. I think it was involving a single company. The profit margin on salt wasn't that great, and so the fact that we were able to win that battle, I'm not minimizing that. I think that it was a huge accomplishment, given all for all the reasons that I said. But I think when you're talking about bluefin tuna, it's much more complicated. There's a very significant economic driver there. You're also infringing on the Japanese ownership over fisheries, about which they feel very strongly. And I think it's going to take some serious diplomatic efforts on behalf of the U.S. and other companies to make some progress on that issue. I really do. And we didn't have that at CITES last year.
Can I make a comment about that? One of the elements of both our stories that really is very, very similar, the element in Monterey and then in San Ignacio, is that when a large commercial enterprise is the only thing going, when there's a monopoly on economic growth and development, then many of the rules are written for that one entity, and things collapse. All of the collapses of marine life in Monterey Bay came when one single enterprise was ruling the day, whether it was whaling or sardines or taking otters or the salt. When that can be countered by a diverse set of opinions about what you should do with a coastline or marine life, when people's livelihoods on land and agriculture and ecotourism and fishing are just as supported as the industrial use that you might be thinking about, when that diversity of voices is heard and in balance, and then things are a lot easier. And one of the amazing stories that you were just telling was that it was empowering people who weren't international corporations to think that their livelihoods mattered. And the same was true in Monterey. When fishing was the only thing going, it was the only decision. But when the aquarium was there, well, then there was another thing to do, and fishing could still happen, and then there's research and teaching, et cetera. So what those two stories have going for them is economic diversity and the balance of opinions about how to use the sea. For bluefin tuna, it's a little more difficult to see what that balance would be, but the person who finds that balance is going to rule the day.
Laguna San Ignacio is a case study of success, place-based but also in species-based in some way. But I'm wondering, where are the Laguna San Ignacio campaigns being fought today? It's a place-based effort. It's a partnership effort. Where might we contribute our efforts? What's happening? Maybe two places you could mention today that are in need of attention and effort.
Well, that's a great question. We won the campaign at Laguna San Ignacio in March 2010. 2000. And, you know, we immediately looked at the campaign and started realizing that there were many other places that were similarly extraordinarily important from a biological perspective, were subject to immediate specific threat, and where NRDC had the potential to develop sort of multifaceted campaigns to protect and preserve them. So in March of 2001, we launched our BioGems program, which I think many of you are familiar with, and we, over the last 10 years, we've identified about 40 places throughout the Americas that are facing similar threats, and where we use the internet to engage citizen activism. We have about 500,000 BioGems defenders, and we've generated, I think, about 12 million messages to government officials and to corporate leaders to leave these particular places alone. We've had a number of successes. I'm now asked Joel to say just a few words about a campaign that he's really been leading, and I've been happy to be of some assistance, involving another extraordinary place up in Alaska called Bristol Bay.
Yeah, every once in a while you get a question that you couldn't have planted any better.
That's right.
And I'm going to be very fast on it, although I could say a lot about this. This is a proposal which some of you may have heard about, many not, called the Pebble Mine. And it's proposed to be located in southwest Alaska at the headwaters of the most productive wild salmon fishery in the world, an industry that generates some $400 million a year and sustains native communities and literally the entire region, its people and its species. This would be the largest gold and copper mine anywhere in the world. Just to give you some sense of the size of it, it would be 2.5 miles long, 2.5 wide, 2.5 miles wide, and a mile deep. If you took every single mine in Alaska that's ever been built and you put them in this pit, it would only fill up 25% of the pit. They're talking about generating 10 billion tons of contaminated mining waste over the life of this mine, which is 3,000 pounds for every man, woman, and child on the planet. These wastes would be contained by 5 dams, each of which is would be larger than the Three Gorges Dam in China. It would cover an area some 54 square miles. So it is an absolute nightmare, but it's real. The Anglo-American, Mitsubishi, and Rio Tinto are the three prime movers in this, and they have already spent some $500 million just on the pre-feasibility studies for this mine. NRDC is heavily engaged in it, working with an extraordinary coalition within Alaska. This is not like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where most people in Alaska think it ought to be drilled. This is actually a project that, because it threatens one of the most important industries and economic generators in Alaska, fisheries, it actually has generated an enormous amount of public opposition. And I think it's a project that we can beat, but I'm not going to tell you that we're going to beat it easily. I think this is going to be a sustained fight. It's going to require a campaign much like the one that you've heard described this evening. And ultimately, we may lose. But I'll tell you, we're going to do everything we possibly can to stop it, because I think this is one of these projects that defines whether we're going to survive as a planet. We can't afford to use our natural resources in this way anymore. And so it's something we have to win. I would urge you all, if you're interested in this and interested in helping, to go to NRDC's website, nrdc.org, and you can find out a lot more information about it. But that's an example, in response to your question, of one of those major campaigns over a threatened and really unique natural area that's going on today.
Unfortunately, we've come to that part of our program where we have time for only one more question. So here it is.
Okay. A question which really picks up on the question that was asked two questions ago about place-based issues, and to what extent, when dealing in another country, can there be institutional answers to specific place-based questions? Maybe, Joel, you got into it in talking about what's happening in Alaska, but I assume that if the SALT project had been proposed in California, it would be there under NEPA and CEQA, Coastal Zone Management, Coastal Commission, and so on, and working with other countries to create institutions which can, in turn, with a local support, deal with and head off undesirable projects would seem sort of a basic answer to a series of place-based questions.
Yeah, let me, Nick, that's a great question. We clearly do operate differently when we're in other countries, and I think what's interesting, we didn't really get a chance to talk about, I mean, the Mexican institutions were really very, very much engaged, and in fact, it was really the Mexican Minister of the Environment who used her authority to sort of stop the first environmental impact statement that was done on the Saltworks project, which basically didn't mention the fact that there were even whales there. And so then she went ahead, and it was kind of interesting. Julio Carabias, who was the Minister of the Environment at that time, actually sort of out of whole cloth created a whole new environmental review procedure, including the creation of a scientific review panel that had not only Mexican scientists but international scientists on it. So those institutions are really important. And one of the things we recognize is that, you know, we focus a lot on Mitsubishi, but when we get involved in these campaigns at the end of the day, in other countries, at the end of the day, it's really up to their governments. And one of the good news is that while, you know, the United States was the leader in creating environmental review processes, environmental regulations, environmental permitting, that we really see that around the world. For example, right now we're involved in a major campaign in Chile, and we're trying to stop the building of 5 dams on 2 pristine rivers in Patagonia. And we're working through an environmental review process, and that may find itself in court. And at the same time, we're trying to put pressure on the company that owns the proposed dams, which happen to be, actually, it's a Spanish company that actually is owned by an Italian company. But it's encouraging to see that these processes do exist in other countries and that we do have levers, and we can work effectively with our partners in other countries to protect and preserve these special areas.
I know we're going to end. I just want to add one thing to that, because I think it's a very important aspect of doing work in other countries. You really need to put together a team within those countries that are from those countries. Mm-hmm. And because I actually consider Alaska a separate country. You know, it's the same thing for me. That, you know, I depend on the people in Alaska to make the moves in Alaska. And we hired in the Laguna San Ignacio campaign, we had the best leadership within Mexico you could ever have. We hired a guy named Andres Rosenthal, who's the former deputy foreign minister in Mexico, an ultimate diplomat. Superb strategist who was so well connected within the upper echelons of the government, and he then brought in the best environmental lawyer Alberto Secoli within Mexico, and they figured out a campaign strategy to use within Mexico that was much like the one that I described, but it was Mexico-based. And we could not have devised that ourselves, and you know, we couldn't have won without the campaign that they put together there. So I think that's very important to recognize the limits of what, as a U.S.-based group, we can do in other countries without their actual engagement.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, Environmental Success Stories, about Monterey Bay, California, and Laguna San Ignacio. There are two important books that you should know about, The Death and Life of Monterey Bay and Conservation in the Internet Age. Our thanks very much to our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet, and our special thanks to Joel and Jacob and Stephen for this wonderful evening. I think we could continue this conversation a lot longer, and I wish we had time. But again, thank you so much. I'm Ann Clark, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 107 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.